If I profane with my unworthiest hand this holy shrine, the gentle sin is this: my lips, two blushing pilgrims, ready stand to smooth that rough touch with a tender kiss.
Good pilgrim, you do wrong your hand too much, which mannerly devotion shows in this. For saints have hands that pilgrims' hands do touch, and palm to palm is holy palmer's kiss.
That famous first exchange between Romeo and Juliet is an example of the many immortal scenes of William Shakespeare, who turns 442 years old today. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. Happy birthday, Shakespeare. This is University of the Air.
What is it about Shakespeare that makes him as alive today in 2006 as when he was born in 1564? What plays will be performed this summer at the American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin? What do actors do to make Shakespeare's magical language accessible to audiences not always familiar with his archaic words? Joining us to celebrate the birthday of William Shakespeare is Shakespeare scholar Richard Knowles, professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and two actors joining us from the American Players Theater, Sarah Day and Brian Mani.
Welcome, everyone, to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you. Pleasure to have you back, in your case, Dick. 442 years old, that's quite a track record for somebody still to be so much in the news every day. What is it that keeps Shakespeare so young?
Well, I think, among other things, the people we have with us here today keep him young. They keep Shakespeare before the audiences in ways that make him exciting, relevant, thrilling. In fact, it's part of the mission, I think, of American Players Theater and other festivals like that to do exactly that. We were talking the other day about how many of these festivals there are. You know of several in Wisconsin, for instance.
Yes. There's the Door Shakespeare Company, and there's also Milwaukee Shakes, which performs throughout the fall, winter, and spring in Milwaukee.
Up until recently, there was the Wisconsin Shakespeare Festival in Platteville, mm-hmm. which for years was sort of the launching point for many actors who have ended up at APT and in Milwaukee and the country.
And can you say something about APT, about American Players Theater, and where it got started and what its mission is?
We're about to start our 27th season at APT. It was founded in 1980 by Randall Duke Kim, Ann Ocho Grosso, and Charles Bright. And its mission was to perform the plays of Shakespeare, using the First Folio, actually, to do plays uncut. It's been a summer festival for the past 26 years and has been keeping its mission to really have Shakespeare as its core, and has continued also to do other great playwrights throughout the world with Chekhov and Moliere. And this year we'll be doing a Madisonian playwright. Thornton Wilder will be performed there this year, as well as George Bernard Shaw. But the mission really is to keep the classics alive in the woods of Wisconsin.
And you're packing them in more than ever, apparently, so Shakespeare still draws the crowds.
Yes, our highest season ever had 110,000 people that came to APT, and last year we had 105,000 people at APT in attendance. So it's been very, very exciting that we have as many crowds as come out to the woods.
Before we get into Shakespeare, I do have to ask a question about what it's like performing outdoors, though, with bats and moths and all of these things. How does that affect the art?
It is certainly different from indoor theater. One of the main differences, as far as a production value goes, is we can never make it dark at will, like you can in an indoor stage. So many times, a couple years ago when we did Hamlet, we had to start that show with the anticipation of a ghost reappearing, and it had to be done in pure daylight. And sometimes when we do student matinees in the fall, it was bright sunlight. It was, 10 in the morning. And we had to create the suspense of a ghost about to appear around that corner or that corner.
Isn't it true that Shakespeare actually invites the audience to imagine, to do just that, to have it be bright daylight, but to imagine at night? I mean, he's sort of aware of that problem as a playwright, isn't he?
Oh, sure. The theaters in London were open air in the sense that the sun beat right down on the stage much of the time. So they had to do night scenes from Macbeth. And so what you have is talk about the lantern and the light it's casting and so on, so as the audience can imagine that.
And as far as the animals we have to perform with, none of them are trained, although there are times when it seems like they are. A bat will fly by right at sometimes it's rarely the most inopportune. It's mostly the most opportune time is when a bat or a bird or some animal will scurry across the stage, and it's always seems to accompany the play that's going on, and the audience loves it. We love it. I mean, it's a bit of a distraction, but it's something we have to deal with.
For the first 2 years, the biggest animal nuisance was mosquitoes, of course. Whenever people came into the theater, they were given a little container of off to spray themselves with. Now they've found better ways of controlling them, I think.
And if you look at the language itself, Dick, because obviously Shakespeare lives not only because the actors are at festivals performing it, but because of Shakespeare himself, the language, the characterizations. What is it from your point of view as a Shakespeare professor that makes Shakespeare still alive and kicking 442 years later?
There is a sheet that I give to my students which shows that it's impossible for people to say more than two or three sentences in English without quoting Shakespeare, whether they know it or not. He just found the perfect turn of phrase, and scholars have analyzed all the things that make that kind of language so memorable. New words much of the time, daring use of old words, getting the right rhythm, piling up the right consonant sounds, vowel sounds, using wit, using paradoxes. He was trained rhetorically. The English education was in rhetorical figures of speech, and he learned hundreds of figures of speech and simply used them in his language almost unconsciously.
Even something as ordinary as skim milk is attributed to Shakespeare. His invention.
It is, yes. And there you have a nice K at the beginning and a K at the end.
Pure poetry in everyday life.
Well, you've got a lot of these, too, that you brought in as examples with It's Greek to Me and Salad Days and If You Claim to Be More Sinned Against Than Sinning.
And so what the dickens?
All kinds of phrases that we don't even realize. Good riddance and dead as a doornail. Things we just say and no longer trace back to Shakespeare.
And one of the marvelous things is that even though you're looking at a sunlit stage, you know that it's darkness there for the moment. You believe that. And it is through the evocative power of language that Shakespeare does this. I remember the very first night I helped to build the American Players Theater, and on the opening night, I remember looking at the stage, which was not finished, and looking at the audience, which was sitting on chairs that hadn't been bolted down yet, and thinking, this is going to be a disaster. And it wasn't, because as soon as the language started to come from the actors, it was magical. I think Sarah has a speech that she likes to say about how the language overcomes the limitations of the stage.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention! A kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars, and at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment. But pardon, gentles all. The flat, unraised spirits that have dared on this unworthy scaffold to bring forth so great an object. Can this cockpit hold the vasty fields of France? Or may we cram within this wooden O the very casks that did affright the air at Agincourt? Oh, pardon. Since a crooked figure may attest in little place a million. And let us, ciphers to this great account, on your imaginary forces work. Suppose within the girdle of these walls are now confined two mighty monarchies, whose high upreared and abutting fronts the perilous narrow ocean parts asunder. Piece out our imperfections with your thoughts. Into a thousand parts divide one man and make imaginary puissance. Think, when we talk of horses, that you see them printing their proud hoofs in the receiving earth. For 'tis your thoughts that now must deck our kings, carry them here and there, jumping o'er times, turning the accomplishment of many years into an hourglass. For the which supply, admit me chorus to this history, who prologue-like your humble patience pray, gently to hear, kindly to judge our play.
So, theater of the mind, even in Shakespeare's time.
Yes, we don't know where that speech was said, whether it was the last play to be put on in the old theater that Shakespeare's company was using, or whether it was the first in the New Globe Theater. But in either case, Shakespeare is apologizing for the limitations of the stage and how the stage and the actors simply aren't up to the great subject, the epic subject of Henry V, the greatest king that England had ever known. And yet, he goes on and does it anyway, doesn't he? And he's apologetic, but the language somehow makes you believe that this is going to be epic and grand.
And in a polite way, that the burden is upon you.
On the audience, too, yes. Use your imaginations to
think of horses if we say them.
We can't put a whole army on the stage, but we'll put two or three soldiers, and you just imagine the rest, and we'll all be happy.
Makes you wonder what Shakespeare would have thought of some of the cinematic adaptations of his works.
Oh, I bet he would have used crowd scenes, don't you?
I think he would have loved
them. I would think.
Yeah, exactly.
He created more than 1,000 characters in his lifetime, and one of the amazing things is how every one of them sounds different from every other character. He clearly envisaged each one of them.
And would you agree with Harold Bloom when he writes in Inventing the Human about Shakespeare that sometimes Shakespeare's characters almost create a concept that until Iago maybe we don't even think about? Kind of evil with Iago and Othello, or that his characters create something.
Certainly, whether there had never been a Iago before in the world, Iago as Shakespeare creates him is more vivid than most of the people like him that we've seen before.
And how does Shakespeare do that? I mean, can you give us an example of how Shakespeare, through his description, makes characters seem larger than life, as if they're breathing?
He does it, of course, largely by the dialogue itself. The things that people say, revealing depths of mind that you have to infer. But sometimes he just does a straight description of a character and gives you a glowing report of what that person is like. The most famous example of this that I can think of is the one in Antony and Cleopatra, where Enobarbus is asked by some Romans, what's it like down there in Egypt? It's like, you know, students, what's it like down in Fort Lauderdale? What about those girls gone wild? And Enobarbus tells them all they want to hear about all the eating and drinking that's going on. But then someone says, what about that Cleopatra that's got Antony around her little finger? And Enobarbus knows that she's poison. I mean, she really is going to end everything. And yet, even so, he is so delighted with her that he launches into one of the most beautiful character descriptions in the world. You want to say that?
Sure. For us? I will tell you. The barge she sat in, like a burnished throne, burnt on the water. The poop was beaten gold, purple the sails, and so perfumed that the winds were lovesick with them. The oars were silver, which to the tune of flutes kept stroke, and made the water which they beat to follow faster as amorous of their strokes. For her own person, it beggared all description. She did lie in her pavilion, cloth of gold, of tissue, or picturing that Venus where we see the fancy outwork nature. On each side her stood pretty dimpled boys, like smiling cupids with diverse colored fans, whose wind did seem to glow the delicate cheeks which they did cool, and what they undid, did. Her gentlewomen, like the Nereides, so many mermaids tended her in the eyes and made their bends adornings. At the helm, a seeming mermaid steers. The silken tackle swell with the touches of those flower-soft hands that yarly frame the office. From the barge, a strange, invisible perfume hits the sense of the adjacent wharves. The city cast her people out upon her, and Antony, enthroned in the marketplace, did sit alone, whistling to the air, which, but for vacancy, had gone to gaze on Cleopatra too, and made a gap in nature. Upon her landing, Antony sent to her, invited her to supper. She replied it would be better he became her guest, which she entreated. Our courteous Antony, whom ne'er the word of no woman heard speak, being barbered 10 times o'er, goes to the feast, and for his ordinary pays his heart for what his eyes eat only. I saw her once, hop 40 paces through the public street, and having lost her breath, she spoke and panted that she did make defect perfection, and breathless power breathe forth. Age cannot wither her, nor custom stale her infinite variety. Other women cloy the appetites they feed, but she makes hungry where most she satisfies. For vilest things become themselves in her, that the holy priests bless her when she is riggish.
Riggish, riggish. Watch out for her when she's riggish. A question for a director here. It's a very vivid, very specific, evocative picture of Cleopatra. But what's going on stage during a piece like this to keep it from being just a talking head?
Well, I actually played this role a couple of years ago at APT, and I hope I didn't turn out like a talking head. But this was the gathering of soldiers, some who knew each other, some who did not. And I think this was sort of a way that news was carried from one port to another, from one continent to another. And so he related... earlier in this scene, he relates the parties that they had. They had heard about these enormous parties they had. He says, and the way they describe it, Enobarba says, that's not even the half of it. and tells about the drinking they've done. And when he relates this, it could be a little bit flowered and it could be a little bit exaggerated, but it's what legends are made of. And I think the talk about Cleopatra probably fed as much into her lore as anything.
Dick, do you want to add something about the language in that passage he just read?
Well, I often refer students in my creative writing courses to this speech if you want to learn how to write description. One of the things that beginning writers tend to do when they write description is to rely almost entirely on visual details. But here you have Shakespeare evoking all the sensory qualities of the scene. You have music, the music of flutes, the calling out of women. You have perfume, the sails of perfume, for heaven's sakes. You have motion. You have texture, that silver cloth of gold tissue, these waves beating the water. And, of course, you have exaggeration to raise these people to bigger than ordinary human dimensions. They are compared with gods and goddesses. She is a goddess of love. She's a Venus. The servants around her are like little Cupids and so on. There's motion. There's sense of attraction going on, sexual attraction. A lot of that language is subliminally very sexual. I mean, I'm always amused by the waves who are being beaten by the oars, and they're saying, beat me some more, beat me some more. I mean, that's a little bit mischievous, is it not? Everything is bigger than life. There's hyperbole, there's color, motion. He simply uses language to complete the scene as fully, for the senses, as imagined. Can be imagined.
We're going to sample some more of the characters of Shakespeare when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we're celebrating William Shakespeare's birthday today with three guests, Richard Knowles, professor of English, and two actors from the American Players Theatre, Sarah Day and Brian Mahoney. Sarah and Brian, can you tell us what the Shakespeare plays are going to be this summer at the American Players Theatre in Spring Green?
We always do, most always do, three Shakespeares. There have been some years where we've done two, but this year we've got three on board. Romeo and Juliet, Measure for Measure, which will be two of the early opening Shakespeares. And then in August, we open with Julius Caesar.
That's quite a range, isn't it? It just suggests some of the different faces of Shakespeare.
And we round it out many times with other classic playwrights.
And this year we're performing The Matchmaker by Thornton Wilder and Arms and the Man by George Bernard Shaw.
With the Shakespeare plays, what is it, do you think, that brings people out? Maybe he created some, but very few of his plots, didn't he?
I think the humanity that Shakespeare portrays on the stage is what people really love. You get rich characters, and in the comedies, even exaggerated. But you get to see you get to see humanity on that stage. You get to see kings fall from grace. You get to see people made fools of and learn a lesson. You get to see lovers who, through the battle against all odds, get together and, unfortunately, sometimes die, which will be in R&J this summer.
Brian is going to be playing one of the great figures. He's playing Julius Caesar. And I'm sure that one of the thrills for the Elizabethans was having Julius Caesar right there, almost within touching distance. They'd read about him in their Latin texts. And there he was, the greatest man in the world, right there in front of him. Hamlet uses the term groundlings, referring to the people in the audience who stand around the stage on the ground. But groundlings also was a kind of a small fish with an immense mouth. And so that's how the audience looked to the actors, just astonished, wide-mouthed, wonder at what's happening in front of them.
I have another kind of a director's question, but also an actor's question, too, regarding some of the so-called minor characters in Shakespeare. What's to stop you from stealing a scene if you have one of those really
Nothing.
Great parts?
Not the director is what will stop us from stealing a scene.
You get spanked.
Well, those minor characters are also part of, I think, what the audience comes for. I had a great time last year during Merry Wives of Windsor playing Bardolph. I had to remember his name. Bardolph, who I think had a dozen, 14 lines, but the director, who had played the role before, knew exactly how to feature some of those moments, and because of set changes, we had to feature him in a couple of scene changes that gave him almost doubled his stage time. And so I had a blast. I had about as much fun playing that role as I have larger, richer roles. Bardolph is a drunk who gets dubbed very early in the play of Merry Wives to have his lifelong ambition fulfilled, which is to become a tapster, a bartender. And he likes to drink up the profits, I think.
He has a bright red face because he's broken all the capillaries in his skin from drinking too much.
And Dick, what are some of, in the three plays that they're going to be doing this summer, what are some of the characters that you would call people's attention to?
Well, the most remarkable, of course, is Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet. As with so many other people on the stage, Shakespeare simply gets inside the character and inhabits the skin of that person and gets fond of him. And there's much more Mercutio than you need there. In fact, you probably don't need him at all. But he's such a brilliant character with his Queen Mab speech and all his wisecracking and indecencies and so on that audiences don't like to see him cut too much. John Dryden once said that Shakespeare had to kill him off halfway through because he was stealing the play from Romeo, who looks rather dull and gloomy until then. And certainly one of the great characters, again, a functional character, but who takes a lot of time on the stage and a lot of space in the play, is the nurse, one of the most beloved of the characters. I think a character beloved of Sarah Day.
Nurse, thou knowest my daughter's of a pretty age.
Oh, faith, I can tell her age into an hour.
Well, she's not 14.
I'll lay 14 in my teeth, yet to my teen be it spoken, I have but 4. She's not 14. How long is it now till Lammas tide?
A fortnight and odd days.
Well, even or odd, of all the days of the year, come Lammas Eve at night, shall she be 14. Susan and she, oh, God rest all Christian souls, were of an age. Well, Susan is with God. She was too good for me. But as I said, on Lammas Eve at night shall she be 14. Oh, that shall she, Mary, I remember it well. Since the earthquake, now 11 years, and she was weaned. I never shall forget it. Of all the days of the year, upon that day. For I had then laid wormwood to my dug, sitting in the sun under the dove-house wall. And my lord and you were then at Mantua. Nay, I do bear a brain. But as I said, when it did taste the wormwood on the nipple of my dug and felt it bitter, oh, pretty fool, to see it tetchy and fall out with the dug. Shake, quoth the dove-house, oh, 'twas no need, I trow, to bid me drudge. And since that time, it is 11 years. Oh, for then she could stand nigh lone. No, nay, by the rood, she could run and waddle all about. For even the day before she broke a brow. And then my husband, oh, God be with his soul, he was a merry man. But took up the child. Yea, quoth he, dost thou fall upon thy face? Thou wilt fall backward when thou hast more wit, wilt thou not, Jewel? And by my holidam, the pretty wretch left crying and said, away. Oh, to see how a jest shall come about. I warrant, and I should live 1,000 years, I never should forget it. Wilt thou not, Jewel, quoth he? And pretty fool. It's stinted, and said, I.
Enough of this. I pray thee, hold thy peace.
Oh, yes, madam. Yet I cannot choose but laugh to think that it should leave crying and say, aye! And yet I warrant it had upon its brow a bump as big as a young cockerel stone. Oh, a perilous knock, and it cried bitterly. Yea, quoth my husband, falst upon thy face. Thou wilt fall backwards when thou comest to age, wilt thou not, Jewel? And it stinted and said, aye!
And stint thou too, I pray thee, nurse, say I.
Peace, I have done. Oh, God mark thee to his grace. Thou was the prettiest babe that e'er I nursed. And I might live to see thee married once. I have my wish.
Well, it seems to me there are a couple of things going on there. I mean, one is we're getting a little bit of a look at Juliet's character being rounded out a little bit with this flashback. But the nurse... really, you do get the impression that she's there for her own sake. I mean, that Shakespeare just couldn't resist once he got started letting this woman spill it all and that there was no stopping her.
And she's the kind of person who loves a joke so much she has to tell it to you 3 times. Appreciate it enough. And we all know people
we
like
all
that.
Know that. Who, yes. Who doesn't have an aunt? Or?
And she's got a good deal of depth to her. She's suffered tragedy. She lost her daughter, and she's lost her husband. And yet she's still this salty, sturdy, talkative, good-humored woman who's very loving of Juliet. Such a warm and full kind of character she is.
Well, and it's comic relief in a very tragic play.
Mm-hmm. And as always with Shakespeare, he's doing something else. She's very salty. She's very bawdy. She's talking about nipples and dugs and about a bump as big as a young cockerel's stone, a young rooster's testicle, and so on. And she's there, as Mercutio is, to remind you of the other side of life, not just that poetic, superhuman love of Romeo and Juliet, but how it goes on daily in other ways, too.
Well, what would you say I did not know that the cockerel stone referred to the testicle until you just said that. There are times, unless I have the book open and I can see what the footnote says, that I know I miss things like that.
So how would she do the visual to make sure that you didn't
but,
miss
I mean,
it?
Do you want that on radio?
Yes. But there are these archaic words. Sometimes mm-hmm. the lines are perfectly clear, or we've mm-hmm. studied the scenes and we remember what the meaning is. But it's true that sometimes it goes right over our head and we miss the joke, right?
Mm-hmm. I hope I haven't corrupted you.
You have, but that's all right.
I think there are many words, even going back to Ina Barba's speech, where the poop was beaten gold. Now, if no one thinks about the poop deck, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure people will leave the play for a moment if they get bothered by that. But I think people who come to these shows, if they don't know a word, they just wait to see what context it's in.
Mm-hmm. And one of the hardest things to do is Shakespeare's stand-up routines between two clowns with lots of puns and double entendre and so on, because it's usually pretty much lost on a modern audience unless they really work hard with gestures and winks and so on.
Because
and
the meanings of the words have changed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And sometimes that can become a very crass festival of people making gesticulations that are... Yeah. Really disgusting to watch, because you kind of go, maybe you could have cut it, instead of having to really pantomime everything from below your waist. So there's an interesting thing about playing the clowns, because they would have been much more understood, I think, by Shakespeare's audiences, a lot more of the what we would consider body language. Mm-hmm. But he used a lot of it, and the people would have enjoyed it. And right now, we're very careful. We think that we've sort of invented somehow body language in our generation. But, oh, my word.
Oh, just read The Taming of the Shrew sometime.
Oh, that alone. That little.
I can see in Shakespeare's comedic characters, I can see the roots and the beginnings of the Monty Python type of humor. It's bizarre. It's
English.
It's English, yes.
But how do you do it? How do you make it accessible to a modern audience? Sometimes you simply have to substitute a word that's close.
Well, a good example where, unless I had known it, I would have missed it, is when Lady Macbeth is trying to urge her husband on to do the deed, and she refers to the poor cat in the adage. And she doesn't give the saying, but it's the one where the cat wants the fish but doesn't want to get wet. And if you know the saying, it makes much more sense. And that's the part that I think for a modern audience, you know, unless you've read it before you go to see it, you're going to miss out a lot of little touches, right?
I used to do a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan in the Union Theater here during the summer, and John Barker, our professor of history, used to provide a glossary for the shows in the program. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's entirely good either, because no one's going to keep looking at the footnotes as they're watching the play.
But you do get more out of Lady Macbeth if you know that's what she's saying. Mm-hmm. So it is a frustration, I think, for modern audiences.
I do think that when the actors have, and the directors, and when the production has done its homework, that there are times when the context will tell you what the word means, and hopefully an audience doesn't get caught up on those single words or phrases. I know that I have to do tons of work. I'm in the middle right now of going through Measure for Measure and figuring out what all these phrases mean so that I can hopefully flesh them out and say them in a way that will convey the meaning. But because I've done Shakespeare quite a lot, doesn't mean that I don't have to look things up. It's required. It's a must. You have to do it.
Are there any kind of new slants to Shakespeare since people are constantly studying and restudying Shakespeare? Any new slants that have come up since you've started doing it? Any new trends in the way you would do a certain scene or put a different spin on it?
I don't know about that. I think people have always toyed with Shakespeare in the way they present it. I just, about a month ago, I went out to Washington, D.C. to see a production of Measure for Measure that was done with puppets. About six or seven of the characters were puppets, and I loved it. I loved it. In fact, I thought it told the story very clearly, and it was very fun, and never seen anything done like that with that play. And so I went with it. It didn't detract at all. I enjoyed it. I don't know. I suppose the movies, there are a lot of movies. There always has been a lot of movies of Shakespeare. And as a classically trained actor, I sometimes will flinch at how common the language ends up sounding. That I think this is poetry. I think it does need to be heightened, but it can't be standoffish to the audience. But I think sometimes the movies make it so colloquial that the beauty of Shakespeare is lost. So I don't know if that's a trend to sort of bring the poetry down and to speak it more street, but I think it's sometimes appropriate, sometimes not.
I think as an American audience member, I think for a long time we were taught somehow that the right way to say it is with a British accent, and that you'll sound really quite affected when you speak Shakespearean language. And then we went through a real thing where it's like, well, how can we, you know, like Marlon Brando, you know, something that you're trying to make it just like so pedestrian that it's nothing. And I think that what David Frank talks about that he loves about our core company and what we're sort of working on is this great marriage of using the poetry of Shakespeare and then the best of American acting, which has to do with really using the modern acting techniques of Stanislavski and being able to wed those two in a way that we have emotion as well as good, as very well, as
diction
well as technique,
plus emotion and
as well as technique, so that it's still understood, but that there is an acting pulse behind it that's different from the stand and deliver that was sort of, I think, off-putting to a lot of people.
You work for a company that is dedicated to doing the plays fairly straight, without gimmicking mm-hmm. them. And the temptation for a director always is to impose his concept on the play. There was a time when, for instance, that very excellent company, Milwaukee Rep, could not do a Shakespeare without gimmicking it somehow, putting a jazz band in a glass cage over the Forest of Arden, or doing Richard III in Star Wars costumes with Moog music, and so on. And it became just so intrusive. You weren't seeing the play itself. You were seeing what somebody had rewritten the play into.
What would you say then? I've seen some adaptations, including in Stratford, where, for example, with Merchant of Venice, it was done with IBM computers.
Really?
I've seen a Romeo and Juliet with motorcycles and that kind of thing. I mean, is it just sort of pushing it, in your opinion, to show an audience, look, we can turn Shakespeare into something for today?
Sometimes it's just egomania on the part of the director, of course. Sometimes it's to make it seem more relevant and up-to-date. And one of the things that APT teaches you again and again is that you don't need to do that to make it relevant and up-to-date. These These are characters you can still recognize from around you today.
Although the Macbeth mm-hmm. from last summer, I thought they had the three witches cast as if they were off State Street, didn't they?
I played the first witch in that, and I was with two younger actors, and I always felt like I was everybody's high school art teacher and two of her students. And I felt very comfortable with that.
But I think what that production didn't do was specifically set it in a particular town with a particular politician or man of authority in mind, which I think then can detract from production, because it'll always speak to people from their own experience, and if you try to put that concept onto them, I think it sometimes steals the possibility of them seeing another sort of parallel in their life, because it's a 1920s gangster production of some play.
You're doing a play this summer, Measure for Measure, which is not one of the more often performed plays. Irwin Knoll, who was the editor of the Progressive magazine, said it was his favorite Shakespearean play because it's about social justice, which is what the Progressive is largely concerned with, too. It's about the possibility of a judge to become corrupted by his own feelings, as a man named Angelo is corrupted in the course of the play. A young woman comes to plead for her brother's life, and he is immediately smitten with her, and though he's a Puritan, falls head over heels for her and says, "Why don't you come back some more and we can talk some more, and then if you'll sacrifice your virginity, we might save your brother's life. How much does your brother mean to you?" And it's a very pessimistic play in some ways, in the view of the corruptibility of human beings. And one of the great moments from that is when Angelo realizes that despite his lifelong reputation for uprightness and his puritanical control of his feelings, he's just being swept away by this young woman, and he comes to realize that, and it's a great revelation to him, a thrilling moment in the play. You want to?
Sure. Jimmy DeVita is going to be playing this role this summer. I won't be. So, Jimmy, if you're listening, don't. What's this? Is this her fault or mine? The tempter or the tempted who sins most? Ha! Not she, nor doth she tempt. But it is I that, lying by the violet in the sun, do as the carrion does, not as the flower, corrupt with virtuous season. Can it be that modesty may more betray our sense than woman's lightness? Having waste ground enough, shall we desire to raise the sanctuary and pitch our evils there? Oh, fie, fie, fie! What dost thou, or what art thou, Angelo? Dost thou desire her foully for those things that make her good? Oh, let her brother live! Thieves for their robbery have authority when judges steal themselves. What? Do I love her, that I desire to hear her speak again, and feast upon her eyes? What is't I dream on? O cunning enemy, that to catch a saint with saints dost bait thy hook! Most dangerous is that temptation that doth goad us on to sin in loving virtue. Never could the strumpet, with all her double vigor, art and nature, once stir my temper. But this virtuous maid subdues me quite. Even till now, when men were fond, I smiled and wondered how.
Now he knows.
Now he knows. And what could be more modern than that? I mean, we're always being tempted. Judges are tempted to misuse their power and influence, and as legislators are, and all sorts of people. I don't think you have to dress that up.
No, I don't think you do.
To make it seem relevant.
What's so wonderful about doing classical theater, whether it be Shakespeare or the Greeks or even Thornton Wilder, is that people in ancient times were just as sophisticated, one could argue even more sophisticated than we are now. And they went through the same toils and troubles, and it's humanity that you're seeing on the stage.
Somebody once asked Sigmund Freud, where do you get your ideas about the unconscious? And he said, I get them from two sources. One, my observation of human beings, and the other is from reading Shakespeare. Huh. And here it seems to me is a very modern moment in the life of Angelo. He has all his life repressed his feelings, his sexual urges and so on, and built up this dam. And once the dam breaks, it just, everything overflows, and he becomes uncontrollable and thoroughly corrupted. It's Freudian reaction formation. I mean, he simply built up this defense, and then when it goes, it goes. I mean, it's very modern, understandable.
We're going to be sampling more of the characters of Shakespeare, including one thought to be Shakespeare himself, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Richard Knowles, and our guests from American Players Theater, Brian Mani and Sarah Day. We're toasting William Shakespeare, the Bard of Avon, on his 442nd birthday, and we're looking at just a few of his characters. We have actually, Dick, seen a couple of instances now in which male characters have gotten swept away by female characters. In one case, a report about, a very glowing, detailed report about Cleopatra, and then also just now in Measure for Measure, a judge, a sober character, getting swept away by a virgin. Well, does it work the other way, too? Do we have instances where females get swept away by male characters?
Well, to return to one of the plays from this summer, yes. Both Romeo and Juliet get swept away. Romeo, almost comically, he's astonished that having sworn never to look at another woman, he looks at Juliet and forgets all about Rosaline. And the other is that young, innocent Juliet, who's never known what it's like to be in love and suddenly is just in another world and can hardly know what's happening to herself. It's, a sign of the range of Shakespeare, that having had the Angelo being swept away into corruption, you have Juliet being swept into bliss.
Gallop apace, you fiery-footed steeds, towards Phoebus' lodging. Such a wagoner as Phaeton would whip you to the west and bring in cloudy night immediately. Spread thy close curtain, love-performing night, that Runaway's eyes may wink and Romeo leap to these arms, untalked of and unseen. Lovers can see to do their amorous rites by their own beauties. Or if love be blind, it best agrees with night. Come, civil knight, thou sober-suited matron all in black, and learn me how to lose a winning match played for a pair of stainless maidenhoods. Hood my unmanned blood baiting in my cheeks with thy black mantle, till strange love grow bold, think true love acted simple modesty. Come, night, come, Romeo, come, thou day in night, for thou wilt lie upon the wings of night, whiter than new snow upon a raven's back. Come, gentle knight, come, loving black-browed knight, give me my Romeo, and when I shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars, and he will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun. Oh! I have bought the mansion of a love, but not possessed it. And though I am sold, not yet enjoyed. Oh, so tedious is this day, as is the night before some festival to an impatient child that hath new robes and may not wear them. Oh, here comes my nurse, and she brings news. And every tongue that speaks but Romeo's name speaks heavenly eloquence.
Swept away.
But what wonderful images contained in that speech.
And you see her being swept from childhood into adulthood then. The images that she turns to are a child's, innocent. I've not gone into the house yet. I haven't put on my new clothes yet. And yet all the eagerness of an adult woman coming out at the same time.
And the way that the happiness, the bliss is captured there makes the painful news and the descent into tragedy the more horrible.
I'm going to have to wipe my eyes, having heard that speech. Well, there's no business like show business, is there? the magic of the theater, and you believe that you're hearing Juliet, and you convince the audience. I'm interested always in what you get from the audience, and what you learn from them, and how you interact with them. And
well, it can't be a play without an audience, and the audiences at APT are remarkable. I think it's the construction of the theater. They seem like they're right in our laps when we're on that stage. And at times, we're in their laps, you know, because there are times we're moving right downstage, right in the front row there. They feel so immediately in contact with us.
For me, one of the things that I think is exciting is because all of our performances begin in the light. And because we're shaped in a thrust stage where the audience is on about... Well, two-thirds of us or so. The audience sees each other, and I think they become a community themselves. And I think that they're seeing each other's reaction to us as well as one another is part of what makes the community of an APT theatrical experience a very special one. We've had a lot of other actors that have worked all over come to APT, and they are amazed by our audiences, so wanting these plays to be good and to really be excited about these plays. And it is such a joy to play for the audiences at APT.
What about the school audiences?
I think those are very rewarding. I happen to think that I enjoy much more doing the more serious plays because, as we talked about earlier, sometimes the language is a little bit of a barrier, particularly with the comedies, where there's wordplay that maybe is words that are a little bit out of the lexicon has not been used by the students that are coming to see the plays. But last year's response to Macbeth particularly was just exciting to see the students as excited and involved in these stories and the sword play and all that. And it's exciting to see people come to APT who were in their formative years. And we hear so many stories of people who came as high school students and then return with their children. And there's something that makes you very happy to think that they wanted to continue that experience.
You get different reactions from pretty much the same play one night to the next, though.
Oh, yeah. We do. There are some nights when you can gauge what sort of an audience you're going to have as to whether they respond to the bawdy jokes or the intellectual turn of a phrase. But every night is different, and the energy they expend bounces back to us, and we give it back to them, and it's a real exchange. It's a dialogue between the two of us.
Are you seeing the audience at all when you're on stage?
In the daylight, of course, and then at night even, if you care to look as an
well,
actor.
Well, that's kind of what I was getting
Yeah,
to.
If you ever, you know, that and there are many times that we do a direct address to the audience and we do look someone in the eye. And yeah, you can see, you know, 8-10 rows back, you can see people's reactions. And if you're directly addressing them, either with a funny or serious monologue, it can be fun. It can be very engaging.
And you've collected some of those things, right, in the book of lore about APT?
What was it? For our 25th anniversary, right. We gathered together from actors, technicians, people who had worked there in the past, patrons, got together and submitted numerous stories. Are there thousands of stories in here?
Hundreds, at least. Would be fair.
But it's called the Book of Lore, and it's got all kinds of anecdotes that about. We were speaking earlier about bats and animals, raccoons, and all those stories are in here.
As well as a lot of lovely photographs that are either backstage photographs or production photos.
Now, we have promised, and I'm very eager to find out about this character. I mean, one theory would be that Shakespeare is drawn in all the characters, but in particular one that you have in mind, Dick.
Well, Prospero, writing the last play probably that Shakespeare wrote by himself, is a magician. He's a controlling character who marshals people about his island and makes their lives turn out in ways they never expected them to. Inevitably, that's going to seem like the playwright controlling his characters like a great puppet master. But what makes it easier for Prospero is that he actually puts on a play, a wedding play, for his daughter and her new husband-to-be, and controls the actors are not real people, they're spirits that this magician controls. And when the play is over, he simply makes the spirits vanish, and all that illusion that something was there on the stage is suddenly gone. And Ferdinand just can't believe what's happened. He looks astonished. And Prospero makes a speech which, first of all, says it's okay, this was just an illusion, but why be surprised at that? Because life itself may be an illusion. We are maybe all the puppets of some other puppet master who's giving this momentary dream and will end it when he feels like doing it. So it becomes a very profound speech. It's, if not autobiographical, at least imaginable as autobiographical.
Our revels now are ended. These are actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits, and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep.
As those plays are surrounded by silence, mm-hmm. darkness on either end.
They are dreams that Shakespeare has given us that we enjoy for 3 or 4 hours and change our lives sometimes.
And if you could direct birthday greetings directly at Shakespeare, what would you say, Dick?
Thank you very much, William Shakespeare. We've enjoyed it. We will come back to you again and again, at least.
And with that, our revels are ended. And thanks to our guests for being with us today, Richard Knowles. Always a pleasure to have you. And our guests from American Players Theater, Brian Mani and Sarah Day.
Thank you.
A pleasure hearing from you, the voices of Shakespeare's characters. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. Hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.